Representatives Schwanke, Mears, Gray, Fields, Prox, and myself, Representative Mina, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Staffing the committee today, we have Andrew Giannotti as our Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, David Monroe as our LIO moderator, and Katie Giorgio, my committee aide. If you need anything during the meeting, please don't hesitate to get their attention. First on the agenda today, we are returning to House Bill 147 by Representative Prox on the practice of naturopathy. I had previously set an amendment deadline for yesterday, January 21st at noon. My office did not receive any amendments. Since it's been a few months since we last heard this bill in committee, I would like to invite Representative Prox and staff Riley Knight to come to the presenter's table. And please give us a recap of House Bill 147.
Thank you, Chair Mina. I'm Representative Mike Prox, represent District 33, and sponsoring House Bill 147, and with me is my aide, Riley Nye. And we did hear several hearings on this bill, so I'm not going to go through all of the details, but at a high level, what we're trying to do is just establish a licensing procedure that meets the education and training or that allows naturopaths to work up to their level of education and training, and very much not the same standards necessarily, but very much what we do with all the other medical professions is they establish the standards at their accredited universities, and we recognize those standards. So roughly, should House Bill 147 pass, a licensed Alaska naturopath who passes appropriate pharmacology exams approved by the department may apply for a temporary endorsement to prescribe medications, and what that temporary endorsement allows is for them to enter into a collaborative agreement with an MD for a minimum of a year, and then depending on the outcome of that collaborative agreement, the collaborating physician would either recommend them for a full prescriptive rights or maybe not. It would be up to that recommendation. And it does require naturopaths to have 60 hours of continuing education, including 20 hours in pharmacology, and naturopaths would not be allowed to prescribe a controlled substance, poison, cancer, chemotherapeutic drug, antipsychotics, or using ionizing radiation or radioactive substances. And we did have some testimony from Gentleman Clyde Jensen from the Rocky Vista University, who told us that they give virtually the same training for allopathic physicians or naturopathic physicians. And what are some of the other? We have 15 other states have this provision. Licensed naturopaths can prescribe medications. There have been no disciplinary actions for prescribing physicians or prescribing naturopaths in those states. And we heard that quite a few patients that come to emergency rooms are really seeking primary care. And we have a primary care shortage in Alaska, primary care physicians. This would help that. It's basically the same level of care, family practice kind of care. And then I think since we last met, the Rural Health Transformation Project came up. And one of the things, it's not naturopath specifically, but one of the requirements is for Alaska to join multi-state licensure compacts for medical providers. There was five of them specific. The naturopaths weren't one, but it's the same idea. They want us to make it easier for medical providers to practice in Alaska. So with that, We do have some folks available to answer questions, but I'd rather just see what questions anybody has, and we'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you for the recap, Representative Prox. Do committee members have any questions or comments? We have a few people available to answer questions in the room. We have Sylvan Robb, the director of the Division of Corporation Business Professional Licensing, Dr. Scott Luper, a naturopathic doctor in Fairbanks, Dr. Clyde Jensen, a PhD professor of pharmacology, as well as Dr. Natalie Wiggins from the Alaska Association of Naturopathic Doctors.
Thank you, Chair Mina. I will make a comment. I am a co-sponsor of House Bill 147, and I want to just explain that for a moment. So allopathic medicine is the antithesis of naturopathic. Under allopathic medicine, we have the medical doctors, doctors of osteopathy, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants like myself. And that's the more traditional medical providers that we have in our community. In Alaska, we have lots of folks who choose not to see traditional medical providers. They would prefer to get their care from a naturopath, and that's for a variety of reasons. And since the late 80s, naturopaths in Alaska have been able to order labs and imaging. They're able to order the tests that would diagnose somebody with diabetes or high cholesterol, but they're not allowed to treat those by the standard of care that I would or somebody in the more traditional path would. Naturopathic medical school involves 4 years of school in which they learn about traditional pharmacology. They know how to prescribe the standard of care medications that would adequately treat these folks who are choosing not to be seen by traditional medical providers. So what we need to do is allow meet folks where they are. And we have Alaskans who are choosing not to be seen, but are having these serious medical problems that because of the way our licensing is, we're creating extra hurdles that they must jump through in order to get adequate treatment. So as the sponsor, Representative Prox said, this is about expanding access. This is about making sure that we have more primary care available, accessible. And what I would offer, and I don't want to say this in a derogatory way, but when we have a system that doesn't allow naturopaths to practice the way they're trained to, we end up with naturopaths in Alaska who are, for lack of a better word, kooky, and they don't use the standard of care. They only use supplements. They really reject sort of traditional medical practice, and that's not in the best interest of our patients. Mm-hmm. We've created a culture that encourages substandard care. And so I think it's time that we pass this bill so that we can attract good naturopaths who will practice the standard of care and medicine in our country and treat folks who need to be treated, who, for a variety of reasons, have chosen not to go a traditional path. So I would urge people to vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Does anybody else on the committee have any questions or comments? Representative Schwanke?
Thank you, Chair Mina. I just want to reiterate Representative Gray's comments. They're much more eloquent than I could ever express. I am also a co-sponsor of this bill. I would absolutely agree that this comes down to increasing opportunities for care for Alaskans. In all honesty, I co-sponsored this bill prior to having an experience in my own family with a naturopath who happens to be listening in and on the line today. I ended up seeking additional advice and input after a family member had a stroke this summer. And as my family member was being discharged from the hospital after having a stroke, we had two physicians give us fairly straightforward diagnoses that he would probably pass within a month after leaving the hospital. And, of course, family members are oftentimes looking for some additional information and comfort and ideas to help them. And with the help of a specific naturopath here, Dr. Looper, who is listening in, I felt like we were able to offer an alternative path. And happy to say that my father is alive and well and enjoying his winter in Florida this year. So we have an opportunity here to write something. As Representative Gray noted, Alaska is one of a growing number of states, I believe 26 states now, that license and regulate naturopath doctors. And it's pretty commonly known that Alaska is the most restrictive when it comes to any sort of pharmaceutical prescriptive authority. So I just want to throw my support behind Representative Prox. Thank you for bringing this bill, and I look forward to passing this out of committee today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schwanke, and great to hear about your father. Does anyone else in the committee have any questions or comments? I would now entertain a motion at this time if there are no further questions.
Chair Mina, I move House Bill 147, Work Order 34-LS0136-G, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 147 passes from committee. Let's take a brief at ease to sign the committee report. Next on the agenda today, we have the initial hearing for House Bill 232 by Representative Gray on mental health age of consent for minors. I'd like to begin by inviting Representative Gray to give a brief introduction on House Bill 232, and my understanding is that we will also be hearing from Senator Giesel and her staff, Paige Brown, to present the bill. Representative Gray?
Thank you, Chair Mina. Yes, so House Bill 232 does several things, but the most important thing that it does is it lowers the age of consent for mental health care from 18 to 16. This would allow 16 and 17-year-olds to seek mental health care up to 5 visits without parental consent. Currently, they are not able to do that. In order to give a more thorough introduction of the bill, I would like to now invite Senator Giesel forward to talk a little bit more about the bill and her staff.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the Health Committee here in the House. For the record, I'm Kathy Giesel. I represent Senate District E. That's House Districts 9 and 10 in the Anchorage area. I am speaking to House Bill 232. As Representative Gray said, this will open the door to allow individuals age 16 and older to access mental health services. This bill is motivated through data and experience. I am a nurse practitioner. I'm board certified in family practice, and my clinical practice site these days, since I can't hold down a full-time job because of this job, I volunteer in our public schools in Anchorage, in the Anchorage School District. During my time serving in the Anchorage School District clinics, I provide physical health services for the students. But in doing so, I also screen for behavioral health challenges that the students might be facing. And in doing so, one of the things that I have observed is, particularly after COVID, the number of students experiencing anxiety, depression, the idea that the world would be better without them has multiplied. I mean, the multiplier is 4 and 5 times what it was before COVID. Our kids were highly stressed by that experience and continue to be so. So I primarily work with middle school students. So we're talking about 12 to 14-year-olds. But when I encounter a student that expresses these issues, we'll explore them together during the visit. Even though I'm there for physical health care, I ask them more questions. And one of the things I say to them is, you know, we have counselors that could help you work through these issues. There are ways that you can manage this anxiety, and the world is not better without you. You are special, and we need you here, but there are folks that can help you with this. Would you be interested in speaking to a counselor? And it is, I think I had one student once say no. Every student has said, yes, I would like to do that. So then I say to them, that's great. I can make that referral. We have clinicians who are here in the school, mental health clinicians here in the school, that can see you just like you're seeing me today during the school day. So your parents don't have to drive anywhere or anything, but we need to get consent from your parents. Inevitably, the child's face falls. Oh, my parents will never give consent. We do contact parents, and you're going to hear from the director of health services, one of the health services contractors at the Anchorage School District, and she'll give the statistics. It's about one-third of the parents actually end up giving consent. So two-thirds of the parents deny the mental health services for their student who has said, yes, I need help. That's what motivates me to do this bill. Because it breaks my heart to see these kids wrestling with these mental health issues that don't have to. There is help available. We have the tools. So the data is that the average age of onset for mental health challenges is about 14 years of age. This isn't something I made up. You can actually, there's a great book out there written by Dr. John Medina. It's called The Attack of the Teenage Brain. He is a brain physiologist. He is on the faculty of the University of Washington. He is a speaker, a public speaker in multiple venues, but he's also spoken at NCSL before. This book is super great. I have recommended it to the parents of teenagers. During the teen years, beginning about age 12 to 14, the brain begins to restructure itself. From infancy, the brain is making neural connections by the billions per second. All of that learning goes on during those preschool and school years. But when they hit teen years and their physiology, their whole body physiology begins to change, those connections begin to reform, breaking down and restructuring as they begin to form adult functions. Prefrontal cortex and executive function processes. And so during this time, teenagers, we know, explore risky behavior. And that's part of that brain restructuring that's going on. They are searching for who they are. Again, that's part of that brain restructuring. So knowing that, that these things begin at age 14, this is the time to really respond when a child says, I can't sleep at night. I'm so worried. I can't sleep at night because I think the world would be better without me. This is the time to reach in and help those kids. So that's the data part. Early detection, we know, results in better treatment. We know prevention is always less costly than treatment. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for people age 15 to 34. And it's a serious issue here in Alaska. 43% of our teens reported feeling sad or hopeless in 2023, some of our latest data. Alaska leads the nation in youth suicide. So getting parental consent from parents is a challenge. There's a lot of reasons for that. You know, mental health issues still have a stigma. And so when parents get a call from a school saying, you know, your child expressed some challenges, behavioral health challenges, and we have services, would you be willing to allow them? That parent is probably going, wait a second, hold it, this is a label. You can see why there would be anxiety and lack of consent. Sometimes there's privacy concerns, particularly in rural areas, right? Small communities, things like that. But we know delaying treatment can have worsening outcomes. You know, when I read stories about some of these horrible school shootings that are executed by teenagers, it breaks my heart because I'm thinking about that child as a junior high kid, even as an elementary school kid. What were they going through that brought them to this horrible point? What could have been prevented if someone had been able to reach out to them and their family, by the way? I'll refer to that in a moment, but the family gets involved here too. But we could prevent a lot of these really heartbreaking situations. In any case, what this bill, House Bill 3232, does is it lowers the age of consent for mental and behavioral health services from 18, which is Alaska's age, down to 16, but there are limitations in it. It's not a wide open thing. It limits it to 5 sessions of therapy. No medication is permitted. That's a key point that many people have expressed concern about. There is no medication involved. In fact, we know that most of these type of mental health challenges don't need medication. It's much better handled with counseling, which then results in lifelong changed behavior, ability to cope. After the 5 services are discontinued, unless parents say yes, and it's at that point that parents are consulted for sure. It may be after only 3 sessions, and the student says, hey, you know, I talked to my mom. I told her I'm having this counseling, and she wants to help too. She wants to get involved. The goal here is that getting the student on the right track, the hope is that the parents will see, wow, my student seems calmer. My child seems better able to talk with me, things like that. What's going on here? Can I get involved too? You know, we can't help a young person unless we help the situation they're living in as well. And a lot of times parents know their children are going through some stressful things. Maybe it's things like bullying that have made the child say, maybe it'd be better if I wasn't here, you know, the suicidal ideation. But the parent doesn't quite know how to help. The clinician can help those parents too and help the family function better as well. So that's actually the ultimate goal, is to get the parents involved as well. We know that we can prevent risky behaviors. If these issues aren't handled at an early age, depression, anxiety, kids commonly turn to substance use. And so we can prevent that. But we want to equip our students. The American School Counselors Association actually has some recommendations. They have some policy priorities. Number one, fully fund public education. Number two, recruit and retain qualified educators. But number three, invest in student mental health. And they are advocating that these services be available in schools where it's a place children feel safe, they go to on a regular basis, and this also, offering the services in the school, the parents aren't having to make an extra trip, another appointment, drive the kids here and there. Now, last year we passed a bill that allows schools to actually set up clinics in the schools. The schools become providers. It would require them to set up billing services and HIPAA-compliant computer systems, etc. What we have going on right now in the Anchorage School District is contractors who in the community who come into the school to provide the behavioral health services. It's happening in Fairbanks also. And the beauty of this is that these private sector entities are actually available on weekends, nights, and when school's out. And so by having them provide the services in the school, the family and the student have the ability to access these clinicians when there's a crisis happening. So because we know everything doesn't happen during the school hours. So that's kind of the outline of what's in the bill and the motivation for doing it. So I'm happy to take any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Do we have any questions for Senator Giesel or her staff? Representative Mears?
Thank you, through the chair, to Senator Giesel. More of a comment and a support. My children are 19 and 22, and I am grateful that I knew about these changes that happen to children as they go through their teenage years. I see where my 22-year-old is compared to where, you know, he was when he was just graduating from high school. His junior year was COVID year. And the differences between how that impacted a high school student and an eighth grader. Seeing all of their friends and all the things that they go through. And as close as I am to my children and their friends, we need other people to be able to talk to. And sometimes the parent or family member is not the right person to talk to about things. That having multiple people in our communities to support our children is really important. And having folks available that have got medical expertise and the background to be able to support them is important. The role that schools and educators are playing in our children's lives are changing. Our communities are changing. And the more support that we can have for them, I think the better off we are. So thank you for your work on this, and I appreciate the conversation and learning more. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess I wanted to first acknowledge that if these services aren't available, people are going to consult AI chatbots, which there are records of AI chatbots include encouraging teens to kill themselves. So I think talking to an actual professional counselor is clearly preferable to AI chatbots, where we don't know what the AI chatbots are going to recommend. I guess my question was on, really important bill. There's some details like 16 years or older. I guess one question I would have is why not 13 because, or 12 even? Certainly, someone could easily need mental health services younger than 16. So should we go a little lower? And girls grow up faster than boys. Their brains develop faster than boys. And maybe if the sponsor could talk about the 5 outpatient appointments, why is that the threshold? I mean, the structure seems really well-designed. I'm just curious if you have thoughts on some of the details in here and how you arrived at those thresholds. Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is an incremental step. I know that this is a new concept for Alaska. About half the states have a lower age of consent. One state does go down to age 12. The rest are majority at age 16. I agree that 14 would be ideal, but we chose 16. The 5 appointments is actually an idea that one of your colleagues, Representative Ruffridge, brought to me. It's the format that another state uses. Other states have these type of services available to kids at younger ages, and this was what one state did. We thought it was a really good structure. I don't recall, but I'm pretty sure that state also prohibited the use of any drugs, any medications.
Just a follow-up.
Follow-up.
I would be curious from both committee members and the bill sponsor if there's interest, like if there's unanimity on the committee that 14-year-olds should be able to access this treatment, I would support that. If it would diminish support for the bill, then I don't want to put it forward and just ask for collective input on the age threshold. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Mina. Through the chair. If we were talking about Kathy Giesel, and if you were willing to clone yourself 20 or 30 times, I wouldn't have any reservations about that. But can't do that. And therein the problem lies. And I think you mentioned that many students say, ooh, don't call parents. And then I think you said about a third of the parents that do get called consent, and the other two-thirds do not. And that's a challenge. And that would bring up a problem in my mind. Ooh, why are they not? And schools are mandatory reporters. And I appreciate the teachers being in a really tight box and anybody that works with kids being in a tight box in that situation. But statistically, from this limited study, 2/3 of the parents are apparently against this. And that brings in a problem because quite a few of the parents that I talk to in the interior, not just North Pole, are just plain taking their children out of public schools because of actions like this. They don't realize that you're the one who's going to be there and it might be somebody else. And so I'm really not being entirely facetious. It's a problem that it will, my concern is it's going to drive more parents away from the public school system. And that's going to cause funding problems and other problems. And we are taking away the authority or we're, what is it, the rats, there's a legal term for children that have not reached the age of majority. We're infringing on that. And it goes broader than just this, where children aren't able to contract. And if they give consent, you were saying that schools are providing the paperwork doing this. So if they're consenting to some treatment from their parents' insurance policy, how are we going to address those sort of issues?
Madam Chair, Representative Prax, let me expand perhaps the patient population we're talking about here. First of all, we're talking about individuals 16 years and older. Not all of these services would be accessed through schools. First of all, I think you're referring to emancipated minors.
Emancipated minors, thank you.
And that's great. Those students can, those young people can give consent for themselves. But there are 17-year-olds that, and 16-year-olds, who are not living at home anymore for various reasons. They are homeless, essentially. Mm-hmm. And they know they need services. They can go to a behavioral health clinic and request services, and they are turned away because they can't get consent.
Right.
Sometimes the parents are incarcerated. Yep. Sometimes the parents have disappeared. So, do we say to this 16 and 17-year-old, sorry, mm-hmm. you're not old enough. Mm-hmm. In fact, they are old enough. Students these days, and you have to actually be in the setting where you're talking to these young people. They are surprisingly astute. They are certainly aware that they have challenges that need to be addressed. They don't want to be anxious. They don't want to be depressed. And they want help. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the parents are not the communication. They're not available for communication. We know one of the questions that I ask the student is there any adult in your life that you can confidently speak to? Straight on, and they will give you good advice. You trust that person. If the student says yes, that student is typically very safe. They have a safe person to go talk to. But there are a lot of kids out there that cannot answer yes to that question. Mm-hmm. Those students are at risk.
Yep.
So it goes beyond just schools. Okay, I want to make sure that we're not talking only about schools here. It happens to be the experience that brings this to the forefront for me. And I should clarify that 2/3 of parents either don't respond, that's a very large number, mm-hmm. And some decline. Mm-hmm. There is an individual that is invited testimony, Heather Ireland, who actually operates or is manager of one of these these clinics, and she can give you actual data. She's kept data. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Follow up?
Yes. Well, yeah, but the root of the problem, I do appreciate what you say, and I'm learning more and more how big the problem is. But the root of the problem is, well, it's parents. I'm going to blame parents because they're parents. You can't blame the children, but the lack of ability to communicate with parents. And parents have the say-so in our society at our level. And I hope we can explore this because that's my concern right now. Are we enabling, to a degree, parents to not be parents instead of recognizing that no harm, no foul, but hey, we got a problem here. We got to sit down and talk and get the parents involved. Don't know. Don't have the answer, but that's my concern right now with this bill.
Representative Fields, and then Greg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just at the risk of stating the obvious, the primary reason that it's hard to get consent from parents on issues as simple as permission to go ice skating at recess is because kids lose notes, parents work two jobs. That's actually the number one barrier. So I just want to recognize that when it comes to behavioral health consultation, which is very time sensitive with someone who's experiencing suicidal ideation, for example, you don't want that person not to get consultation because their parent was working two shifts or the note got lost from their backpack. So it's not just an issue of the parents who won't give consent. I think the bigger issue is why would we let this minor logistical issue get in the way of time sensitive medical attention? So again, thank you. And I don't know if Senator Giza wants to comment on that, but I see that all the time in my school, and it's unbelievable how hard it is to get notes back, again, on stuff as simple as ice skating at recess.
Madam Chair, could I comment on that?
Go
thank
ahead.
You. Not only are parents working two jobs, but we're using a plural, parents. Sometimes there's one parent. Sometimes that parent isn't home much. Some of the stories that I've been told, one of the questions I ask students is, how many hours do you sleep at night? That tells me a lot about their health, right? We know that our bodies repair during sleep. But it also tells me how well their brain is repairing, because that's what happens when we sleep. To have a student tell me, oh, I go to sleep about 3 a.m., I have to get up at 5. Really? Why don't you go to bed sooner? What's going on? Well, my mom goes out at night, and so I have younger brothers and sisters I have to look after. I worry that my mom won't come back. No middle school student should have to be thinking these kinds of things, worried about this kind of problem. But that's the reality. In Anchorage, in Alaska, I mentioned suicide, you know, last spring when this bill was going through the other body, there were 4 suicides sequentially in the North Slope borough, same school. Why are we sitting by and watching this? There had to be signs that someone could have reached out and provided services for those students. And that's just one example. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm just going to make a comment based on the line of questioning from Representative Prox. And that is, when I was 17 years old, I was very rebellious. I was sneaking out of my parents' house all the time. I was drinking heavily, getting in a lot of trouble. And my parents forced me to get mental health care. And when you force a 17-year-old to do anything, it doesn't go well. It was really a waste of their time and money and effort. And so when I think about the bill, I think about if there had been an opportunity for me to seek out mental health care on my own in some way, shape, or form, and I had chosen that, it might have made a difference. It might have gone better. And so I think, especially when we're talking about 16 and 17-year-olds and what parents can and can't make them do, I think sometimes at least in my case, my parents created this obstacle. I was opposed to receiving any sort of mental health care. So I'm just giving the sort of alternative view that allowing kids to proactively consent to this sort of care will make the care more beneficial.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, this bill is broad authority for children to consent or authorize care. Schools, hospitals, wherever. Is that true?
That would be true, yes, okay. Madam Chair.
And then, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the legal terms, but in the medical industry, which you're familiar with, you can get medical power of attorney. You can give medical a power of attorney to your husband or your daughter or, I suppose, me. I don't know if I'd do that, but, you know, you could do that, I think, right? And then there is prior authorization to not take care in a hospital. I don't remember what that's called, but if you find yourself in a really difficult situation, do not resuscitate orders, for instance. We can sign those ourselves. Correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Madam Chair, yes.
Would it be worth considering, especially, I guess, in the school environment, that parents could opt in with that consent, I don't know, first day of school or whatever, but think about it. We offer this service. If you need it, we can't get in touch with you, da-da-da-da-da. And maybe for skating rinks and all that other stuff, where they'd opt in at the start of school, for instance. Is that a possible solution to solving at least part of this problem, where parents are still in control? I guess that's where I'm thinking about it.
Madam Chair, this is already done with physical care at the beginning of the year. Actually, when the students register for school, they allow physical care, school nurse or the sports physical.
Right.
That would be up to school districts. I don't know.
Right.
Yes. But there is a person, invited testimony, that actually is the manager of a clinic that offers referrals. Mm-hmm. She can talk about data. I also have an invited testifier who is a high school student mm-hmm. who can certainly speak to this and her experience with her colleagues.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Mina. Through the chair, thank you, Senator, for being here. I wanted to go just briefly to the matter of cost, and I think that might be also for the invited testifier as well. So on page 4 of the bill, line 30, the minor is relieved of financial obligations to the provider of a service under this section. Is there an idea of how I guess I'm not aware of so providers would essentially be offering the service pro bono, or would this seems to indicate that the minor would not be responsible for any payment as well. How would you envision letter F of this bill to be implemented?
Madam Chair, Representative Ruffridge, the way this works, if it's a school setting right now, is the student's insurance covers, right? So the billing goes to insurance. That is typically, or often, is Medicaid. So Medicaid is automatically billed, or the student's insurance. But you're right. Otherwise, it is pro bono care. The people, the clinical social workers, licensed professional counselors, psychologists, et cetera, that provide these kinds of services they're amazing people who do provide a lot of pro bono care. So I think, again, we have invited testimony, a person who manages these kinds of services. She could best answer that. But having spoken to some clinical social workers, they recognize the desperation of individuals and often do pro bono care.
Just a follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up.
Thank you. I guess my concern for letter F is I agree with you. I think there's a lot of amazing people in this line of work that would offer pro bono care. This section just seems to be very rigid. So if a minor wanted to seek care from a facility, let's say a 17-year-old is not in school, drives themselves to a facility for mental health services, and that facility wanted to receive remuneration for said services, this section seems to prohibit them from doing so. Is that how you read that?
That is not how I read it.
Okay.
I read it more as a permission. But I understand. I understand how you're reading it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Senator Giesel, for being here. And, you know, this bill, I very much understand where you're coming from, where Rep. Gray's coming from on this. I'm a parent of a teenager. I've been a youth sports coach. Mm-hmm. I've been a volunteer educator. Been around an awful lot of kids. I've had a lot of really hard conversations with kids that were struggling. So I very much understand where you're coming from. You made a comment that really kind of got me. You said the ultimate goal here is to get parents involved, but this bill does exactly the opposite. How do we reconcile that reality? Because as parents, we do have ultimate control and say over our children's lives until they are no longer a minor. And then I kind of have a follow-up question I'll just throw out at the same time. So you mentioned that there were several other states that had these opportunities for minors to seek care without parental guidance. You also made a statement that by doing this, we can perhaps change the course of suicide rates. Is there evidence to support that?
Madam Chair? Representative Schwanke. First of all, you're asking for evidence that prevention worked, and that's impossible. It's like saying we've saved money by vaccinating against measles. Well, I guess if we stop vaccinating measles, we'll find out, won't we? So have we prevented suicides? That would be an interesting question for some clinicians. I believe they would identify the positive outcomes. I can't enumerate that. I can't put that into numbers. When a child is having these kinds of issues at home, at school, or personally, anxiety, depression, anger issues, these are playing out in the family situation also, not just at school. And I have hope, I don't have proof of this, but as the child is, the student, the person, the young person, is given the tools to control their anger, to deal with the anxiety, that will be, I believe, evident to the people around them. We have reports from teachers in classrooms where these services are available that this has made a huge difference in the classrooms. As the student is getting services during the school day, that the classroom conduct is completely different. They're doing so much better. I believe that will ripple out to parents, and it will be noticeable that the parent will follow up and find out how are you doing so well. I think we will actually reach parents with the positive evidence in their children. I have no proof of that. We have proof of it in schools for the students that do get services.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
I have no doubt that there are individual students and individual young people that will say, yes, this is very helpful, and it had helped them. That I don't doubt. My concern comes in when a parent finds out, when a parent understands that this is happening, especially in a school setting. If there's billing that happens, if a Medicaid charge is forwarded on behalf of a student and it comes back to the parent, I have to agree with Representative Prox. This is going to absolutely result in more students being pulled out of our public schools if this happens within the school, unless there are some sort of caveats, some sort of opt-out opportunities for parents. So I really have a concern with that. And I would, to me, if the ultimate goal is to get parents involved, then the minute that a school hears or understands that a youth is having issues, they contact the parent every time. And in my experience in local school districts that I've been involved with, that is the case. So I'm going to wrestle with this bill significantly, but I do appreciate you bringing it and trying to make an attempt to help our young people, because we do have a lot of them that are going through some pretty severe mental health issues. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to make a quick comment before we go turn to the invited testimony. I had the opportunity to be a part of the National Conference of State Legislatures Youth Homelessness Fellowship, and learning about what other states have been doing to really address this issue of youth homelessness. Part of that program, I was able to see different organizations in other states and also talk with a lot of our partners on the ground in Anchorage, in the MATSU, and ask what are low-hanging fruit that we can do in the legislature to be able to help youth experiencing homelessness. And the minor mental health age of consent was one of the biggest things that people were talking about. And it really is, when I think about this issue of access to youth behavioral health services, it happens so frequently that it is the situation of a youth who doesn't have that contact with the parents that wants to seek help. And the folks who are in between are trying the best that they can to have any sort of response or engagement from a parent, even if they are available, and they can't. And it's painful that you have a child or a teen who wants to seek help, and it's the lack of engagement, no matter what the provider in between can do. So that really helped enlighten how this bill fits in context with our other broader issues, such as youth experiencing homelessness. So just wanted to comment on that. If we have no other questions or comments at this time, I will now turn to the invited testimony for House Bill 232. Before we turn to the invited testimony, would we like to hear a sectional or committee members? Good. All right. Well, we'll turn to the invited testimony for House Bill 232. First, we have Teresa Roble, Policy and Advocacy Program Specialist at the Alaska Children's Trust.
Good afternoon, committee. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Good afternoon, Chair Mina and committee members. For the record, I am Teresa Roble, Program Specialist for Policy and Advocacy at the Alaska Children's Trust. Today, I'm testifying in support of House Bill 232, which would allow 16 and 17-year-olds the ability to provide self-consent to receive up to 5 behavioral health treatment sessions. At the Alaska Children's Trust, we believe in a future where Alaska's children, youth, and families have the knowledge, skills, supports, and resources they need to thrive. Achieving this vision means ensuring that the next generation of parents, especially those navigating adversity, have access to timely behavioral health support before challenges escalate into crisis or harm, and ensure they are equipped with the tools and protective factors they need as they enter adulthood and become parents themselves. According to Kids Count 2025, 2 out of every 5 high school students in Alaska report feeling persistently sad or hopeless for an extended period during the previous year, a nearly 60% increase since 2009. This number has steadily moved upward, increasing almost 60% in the past decade. attempted suicide rates among high school students in Alaska have generally increased over the years, with statewide rates rising from 10.7% in 2007 to 19% in 2023. These numbers highlight the urgent need to remove barriers to mental health services. House Bill 232 creates a critical pathway for 16 and 17-year-olds to access behavioral health services in situations where seeking parental consent may be unsafe, unrealistic, or act as a barrier to care. Alaska's youth experience a wide range of family circumstances, including exposure to trauma, substance misuse, domestic violence, neglect, or housing instability. In these situations, the inability to access early support can compound harm. This bill carefully balances the importance of parental involvement in treatment while also recognizing that limited short-term access to care can be life-saving for some youth. Importantly, House Bill 232 is intentionally limited in scope. It does not allow for the prescription of medication, nor does it remove parents from the broader behavioral health system. It does provide a narrow preventative opportunity for early intervention, an approach that aligns with best practices in public health and mental health services. From a prevention standpoint, this bill is especially important. Research consistently shows that unaddressed mental health needs during adolescence increase the risk of substance misuse, unsafe coping behaviors, family conflict, and future involvement in systems designed to respond after harm has occurred. By allowing youth to access brief of behavioral health support earlier, House Bill 232 helps reduce the likelihood that challenges escalate into situations that result in abuse, neglect, or system involvement. And as our future parents, this bill ensures they have the tools they need to thrive, which greatly reduces their risk of entering the child welfare system. The option for youth to consent to behavioral health treatment is a policy choice implemented in states across the country. Research demonstrates that allowing youth to self-consent for behavioral health services can support youth engagement in treatment and empower youth to make informed decisions, leading to more effective care. House Bill 232 reflects a balanced approach that prioritizes prevention, early intervention, and youth well-being while respecting the role of parents. By expanding access to behavioral health services, this bill strengthens Alaska's commitment to primary prevention and support healthier outcomes for our youth as they transition into adulthood. We encourage your support of House Bill 232. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Wobo, for your testimony. Our next testifier is Lance Johnson, COO at Alaska Behavioral Health Association.
Thank you. Just doing an audio check.
We can hear you. Great.
Great. Thank you, Chair Mina, Representative Gray, members of House HEF. For the record, my name is Lance Johnson. I'm the COO for the Alaska Behavioral Health Association, a trade organization for over 115 community behavioral health providers and stakeholders in the state. I'm offering my support for HB 232 and appreciate this companion bill being put forward by Representative Gray so SB 90 doesn't get lost in HB 36. I've got a whole script here, but I'm at the risk of... going off tangent, I want to respond to a couple of things that I heard, if I may, and just color in the lines a little bit. We've heard a lot of some stats and everything else. I just want to remind everybody in the committee that, as Senator Giesel pointed out, this is not just about school access for care. This is about youth who want to go to their community behavioral health clinics. And maybe primary care, where the referrals can be sent over to community behavioral health. So we need to think about multiple access points that youth can have. And the more access points that we have available, the more accessibility there will be for these youth. I think Ms. Roble gave you several different stats. And I just want to point out one national one. I'll skip the ones that I have here, but between 2020 and June 2024, the age category presenting at Alaskan emergency rooms for suicide attempt-related needs were 11 to 14-year-olds and 15 to 19-year-olds per 1,000 ER visits. That's the highest statistical categories of any group. And locally, I've been in the field for many years, and for 12 years I worked in rural Alaska as a behavioral health services director. And locally, we just encountered so many heartbreaking situations. In 1 year, we had a 9-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 12-year-old commit suicide, not attempt, but complete suicide. In that same span, I had a 16-year-old reach out to me personally looking for services, but unfortunately, and through best efforts, we could not obtain parental consent to proceed. We looked at other resources and a possible parent negligence complaint with OCS, but the youth attempted suicide in that time. Upon turning 18, she was able to enroll in services on her own and now continues to thrive, but the cost of waiting almost cost her life. Senator Giesel hit on stigma as a reason that parents and guardians may not want their children to be enrolled in treatment services or to have access to treatment services on their own. And that's very true. That's true for adults as well, just not wanting to seek services because of the perceived stigma out there. But I've heard a lot about the reasons why parents may not cooperate. And it could be their own experiences with behavioral health services that weren't positive. It could be that they're just negligent in signing consent forms or what have you. But what I haven't heard here today is that youth who want services may be seeking those services because of the trauma that their parents or guardians have caused them. So to involve them and get consent from them is almost impossible because those families are going to be very protective of what's happening inside the house or in the community or wherever it may be. So I don't want to just focus on the fact that we should have parents always involved. Sometimes it's not clinically sound because of their involvement in their children's needs. So I also heard here that, you know, payment is an issue, certainly, and I appreciate that being brought up. This is why it's really important that there are community behavioral health grants, because you're absolutely right. There will be pro bono services given because of the field that we're in and knowing that we have to provide services to these youth. But that can be expensive for agencies, too. They can only do that so much, especially these smaller agencies. So these grants are really important, and that can help cover those services. The asking about evidence as well about, you know, how do we know these are having positive outcomes? I can tell you, and I can't quote the data, I'm happy to provide it once I do. In Minnesota, where they offer 12 services before you involve family, you can do it before that, of course, as Senator Giesel pointed out, but they offer up to 12 services first. In Minnesota, those numbers of youth suicide have gone down as a result of that access being given. This is also true in New Mexico as well. So I can pull current data and submit that when I have a moment, if you're interested in that. But HB 232, it enhances AS 20.025, and a lot of great work has been put into the language of this bill. I like that it has five services there. We're not pioneers in this area, as I said, so I would be willing to support even more services. And again, using sound clinical judgment, putting the faith in clinicians and counselors to involve the family where it is feasible, where it is to the betterment of the youth involved, but also to make those clinical decisions where it would be a detriment, sort of such as that trauma that I brought up that they may be causing. I have two suggestions that I think would make this bill a little bit stronger. AAC 160.990, this is a definition section, behavioral health services, which is put in this bill in the language quite a bit. It's defined in regulation as behavioral health clinic services and behavioral health rehabilitation services. That's a big scope. It includes a lot of services, which is great. And we know that this bill would not include in that prescriptions or medications that could be used in this intervention. But that definition excludes the majority of substance use services. And I don't want to overlook this. You know, in the most recent YRBS, 22% use alcohol regularly in schools, 13.1% were binge drinking, 21.5% were using marijuana. And the substances are often a catalyst for a youth to self-harm, to attempt suicide. Sometimes they're using it as numbing agents. So it's important to be able to have access to those type of counseling services as well. Because there's often co-occurring disorders, right? So I would suggest in lines 29 through 31 on page 2 under A to read, a minor who is 16 years of age or older may give consent to receive outpatient behavioral health or mental health services under the state plan and 1115 waiver services. Almost all of the substance use services are under the 1115 waiver now. So I would not want to exclude that because it's an important part of treatment where it's applicable. I'd also suggest that in lines 29 through 31, but throughout the bill, I'd recommend changing instances of mental health provider. I would suggest using mental health and or substance use disorder provider because I'd really encourage this bill to focus on the whole issue. And we know through our data that, and I can speak from my experience locally in rural Alaska, that a high percentage of the cases, and I won't give you a false number because I don't remember off the top of my head right now, but I know it's a high percentage of cases where there is an attempt at suicide, substances are on board. So again, I think it's really important to broaden who can provide those services. And I'm with Representative Fields. I would be very supportive of even lowering that, again, not to the detriment of this bill being passed, but 14 years of age is very realistic. Youth today are exposed to so much more at a younger age, and I have had to turn away 14-year-olds so many times who have come to want services, and I can't do it because I can't get parental permission or, again, negligence on the parent part, or they're just not in the lives of these youth. So, emphasize, I think Ms. Robel said this as well, that, you know, this bill is not seeking to remove parents and guardians from consenting to services. Outcomes for youth are much better when the family is involved, for sure. But this is a bill that addresses youth consent when families choose not to participate. So I encourage you to please support this bill. We can't have the status quo any longer. We need to get these youth into services much sooner, especially when they want them and they can't get the support at home. So thank you for your ongoing commitment to Alaskans and all your hard work. I truly appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Looks like we have a question from Representative Fields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I mean, I guess I would be interested in Mr. Johnson's take, but this question is also for you and for the bill sponsors. So the structure of this bill adds behavioral, mental health, following medical. We could also make the case that behavioral and mental health services are part of medical services, and maybe the bill sponsors or Dr. Johnson want to address what's the best way systematically to address behavioral mental health in statute, because I'm sure that the term medical applies elsewhere. Do we want to be adding behavioral and mental health throughout statute, or would it be better to define medical care throughout statute to include behavioral health? It's just a structural question, but I don't want to expand it here and then, you know, in some other area of statute have ambiguity about whether behavioral health services are covered because we added behavioral here but not elsewhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Mr. Johnson, do you have a response?
I do, and this is part of my script that I left out as well. I think I have a whole thing to hear about that section of regulation, that it does include medical. The definition for medical is not well defined in regulation. I would argue that medical should include behavioral health and substance use services as well. So it could be a tweak of that language, particularly because it's not in definition.
Okay, can I ask a follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
I guess the follow-up for the bill sponsors and maybe legislative legal would be, is there a way we can put in this bill clarifying that throughout statute it is our intent that medical care includes behavioral and mental health services? Is there a way to do that in this bill and just be done with it? Thank you.
Thank you.
You know what? Actually, I don't have a response right now.
Representative Prox?
Yeah, and just kind of a time check. There's still a couple of more testifiers. I do, at this point, have a question for Mr. Johnson, but I don't want to run out of time before the other testifier. So,
we're doing good. You can go ahead.
Doing good. Okay. So, Mr. Johnson, you talked about lack of access, and right, I'm trying to figure out what we have right now. We have youth shelters. I can think of a couple in the Fairbanks area. If a child goes to a youth shelter, then these services would be available, is my understanding today. Is that correct, or can you help me with that?
Sure, through the chair. It depends on what you're considering shelters. If we're talking about, homeless shelters, they may or may not have those services, but they do have people who would refer out to those services where they're unavailable. I would say, again, it's another access point for either on-site treatment or for referral to those who can provide that.
Mm-hmm. And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Yeah. And also, you mentioned, I think you kind of, you said that, you know, if parents don't get involved or refuse to get involved, that's kind of an indication of child abuse, or could be. My reading of the mandatory reporting requirements would lead me to conclude that if a parent is asked, doesn't consent, that is a reportable event. The mandatory reporter would be held liable if they didn't report that event. Can you tell me how that works a little better?
Sure. Through the chair, excuse me. We have reported to OCS, providers have reported to OCS when there is a non-response or a particularly let's say that you've tried all your best, and under the current statute, there is the ability to seek out those parents and ask them to please give counsel. Here's what's going on with the youth, if that's if it's appropriate. The thing is that if the parents are willfully being negligent, if they even if they're agreed to it and aren't bringing their youth or making them accessible for treatment, those are reportable for sure. You have to weigh that clinically to see how that would play into the treatment of the youth. But I said in here earlier that that 16-year-old that came to me and ultimately attempted suicide, that we were working with OCS to present a negligent case on those parents. I guess the short answer is yes, that is a tool, but it's a lesser tool that will be needed if these youth can access services first without having to go through parents who, again, may be the source of trauma.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. Thank you. Through the chair, I guess I want to press that a little more. You're a clinician. You probably have a license or something like that for your job. If I was a hockey coach, I would think that if I was confronted with that situation, I wouldn't impose any clinical evaluation on that. I would be required to report that to OCS. How does that differ in your situation?
Through the chair, not everything is reportable. Again, have the parents even been attempted to be contacted? Where does negligence come in as far as when you have, let's take a youth who has reported suicidal ideation, reaching out to the parents don't respond, they do multiple attempts, that could be a reportable offense, and you would go ahead and call OCS, they would screen it out, they would determine whether or not it's negligence and to move further through supervision of the youth or removal of the youth from the home. But not every case will be reportable, only because the parents could have been out of town. The parents, for whatever reason, couldn't be accessed right away. So you have to do your due diligence before you take that step.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to reply to Representative Field's question about the addition of the words behavioral and mental health after the words medical in the bill. As a medical provider, I absolutely provide mental health care all the time. Mental health care is part of medical care. But in this case, we are giving consent to a 16 and 17-year-old to consent only to mental and behavioral health. So if we didn't have it here, it would be consenting to medical care, and that's not the point of the bill. And the difference is that although my license allows me to provide mental health care, in this case, we need people who – we don't need somebody who also does medical care. We just need somebody who does mental health care. So it's really allowing for this bill to be very specific about the type of care that we're providing. It's not about changing the definition of medical care. It's about just basically specifying out two aspects of medical care so that we can just – allow this very narrow consent to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schwanke and then Representative Mears.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Johnson, I have kind of a side question. Could you describe what the different service looks like when, say, a youth calls the suicide hotline versus maybe walking into your office, your facility?
Sure. Through the chair, when they call the care line or 988, they will sometimes be able to be handled by the professionals who are on that line. And maybe it's something that they're just feeling down, but they're not suicidal. These are trained professionals on the care line to be able to make those determinations. Often, though, if they feel there is something more to this, they will do referrals out to agencies in that person's local community where they exist. If they don't, in most even in rural communities, they have access points for sure. And, of course, in this world today with telehealth, it can provide even more access. So it's a two-step procedure. It may be able to be handled competently and appropriately through the care line professionals, but when more service is needed or they determine that, hey, would you like to receive services, and the youth says yes, they can refer that youth to their local community, be it their health clinic or whatever may exist there.
Thank you.
Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. I'll get to a question at the end, but I've got a little journey stitching some things together. So one of my desired goals from serving on this committee is to be able to do what we can to address things upstream. My Thursdays and Tuesdays are interesting because we start with Community and Regional Affairs, where we talk about Department of Public Safety and the Department of Corrections, and we've had, you know, DOC folks in here. Our Department of Corrections is the largest provider of mental health services in the state. Folks that are incarcerated, very often there is substance issues involved with how they ended up there. We discussed earlier today how the sooner we can provide care, the better we are. Mr. Johnson talked about youth turning to substances for numbing, but really I believe it's self-medication and self-medication leading to substance misuse. The sooner that we can provide services and get ahead of things, it's not just dollars cost, but it's cost to our community. So having a proposal like this, it seems like we're getting a little further upstream, and there's space to go a little further. The further upstream we can go, the happier I am. I think that's where our responsibility lies. So, Mr. Johnson, I guess on the question end, you know, if you could expand a little bit on if I'm on the right track with youth seeking numbing, if that has a connection to self-medication and then the potential for further substance misuse.
Yes, through the chair. Absolutely. Definitely could be self-medication and using different substances for sure. That can lead to, as we know, decisions that they might not normally make if they are sober or not using, if they're clear-headed, let's say. And so that's why I'm really trying to impress on the committee for this bill that we should not exclude substance use services here, because those prevention services and those treatment services could really make the difference in helping that youth get through the mental concerns that they have. So that's why we shouldn't ignore that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Mr. Johnson.
I just want to point out, too, in the statute in 25.20.025, that in Section 8.4, a minor can give consent for diagnosis, prevention, or treatment of pregnancy, and for diagnosis and treatment of venereal disease. That's a big deal. They can give their own consent for that. To me, that just means they really should be able to give consent for their mental health needs as well. So I just want to point out there is some exceptions to consent already in that statute, and I really believe that there should be for these behavioral health services.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Seeing no other questions, we do have two more testifiers for House Bill 232, so I'd like to get through those testifiers. Next, we have Heather Ireland, Executive Director for the Anchorage School-Based Health Centers. Ms. Ireland.
Chair Mina and House and Health and Social Services Committee members, my name is Heather Ireland. For over 10 years, I've served as Executive Director of Anchorage School-Based Health Centers, a division of Christian Health Associates. Listening to committee questions, my testimony has grown, but I'll try to be quick. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the importance of House Bill 232. If you want to make a difference in adolescent mental health, you will pass this bill. Allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to access behavioral health services, even for a limited number of sessions, has the potential to make a huge difference in their lives. We're grateful for the volunteer services Senator Diesel has provided. She spoke eloquently and comprehensively about the need for this bill. Anchorage School-Based Health Centers is a nonprofit separate from the Anchorage School District operating medical clinics in high schools and middle schools. And the care that we provide is for those that cannot access it in the community. Parental consent is required for students to receive medical care from advanced nurse practitioners and doctors in our clinic. Anchorage School-Based Health Centers has served thousands of students since the inception in 2010. Similar to providers in the community, our medical providers screen for many types of risks, and we have seen increasing numbers of students who exhibit symptoms of depression, anxiety, and other behavioral health challenges. Also, we see students for acute care, which present with medical issues like belly pain or insomnia, but it's really more of a psychological than physical issue. Schools often concur with our initial assessment that youth are struggling. And more often than not, students are willing to pursue behavioral health treatment. Probably 75% of the students that have concerns are willing to get treatment. 25% of the students in our clinic are unwilling for clinic providers to even consider approaching their parents. Of the parents who are approached, parental consent is a huge barrier for the youth to access the care they desperately need and want, unfortunately. Frequently, youth are hesitant to ask their parents for treatment. My observation has been that the adults are reluctant to give permission because of the stigma associated with mental illness, which the younger generation has moved past. It can also be logistically challenging for adults to give consent, especially in the school setting where families are not present. And finally, some adults don't want their student discussing their personal life with a healthcare professional, despite how desperately they need the treatment. I only have data on students seen in the clinic and referred. The district keeps track of all the school-based providers and the numbers of referred students who enroll. I will try to get that data from them for the future. Years ago, through my networking with school-based health programs in other states, I learned that Colorado lowered the age of consent from 16 to 12. It was like a lightning bolt. This is a way that we can actually help kids. Sadly, after many years, Alaska has done nothing to change the situation. A higher age of consent for mental health treatment is correlated with a higher suicide rate. When you look at the rankings of suicide rates, of the three states with the lowest rates of suicide, the age of consent is 16 or lower. Of the states with the highest suicide rates, including Alaska, the age of consent is 18. Obviously, there are many factors that influence the suicide rates in Alaska, but by allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to consent for their own care, it would only be one tool to help youth. Youth can connect with a clinician who can assess their safety and broach the possibility of involving the parent in their treatment. Early access to care prevents issues from developing into a crisis and needing hospitalization or worse. In 2018, a study in Minnesota showed that a school-based mental health program reduced self-reported suicide by 15%. This is just one example of how increasing access to care can make a difference. Early intervention not only helps youth and families, but it also saves money and saves lives. The limited number of sessions stipulated in the bill allows for the clinician to coach the student how to talk to their parent about the value of the services provided. Ideally, the parents consent to continued care. The current limited access to care makes it impossible even to help a student navigate this conversation with their parent. Some people might have criticisms of this bill. Of course, parents would like to know everything that their child does, But that is not a reality for some families. Prohibiting access to mental health treatment may enable further abuse. In cases where abuse is not a concern, mental health providers would explore with students their reluctance to letting parents know about mental health needs and give them tools to communicate. This bill does not force providers to see youth for free in the community. There are grants that support both school-based care and mental health community mental health services. Plus, as Senator Giesel mentioned, pro bono care is an option for clinicians or providers in an or provider organization. Like Representative Muir said, adults outside the family can be a tremendous support for youth. As a parent, I would much rather my daughters access care without my knowledge than suffer the consequences of untreated mental health issues, including suicide. Please pass House Bill 232. Please help youth who are struggling. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ireland. Representative Prox.
Thank you, Ms. Ireland. Through the chair, if you encounter a parent that is reluctant to give permission for their child to get mental health services, at what point do you report that to OCC? OCC, Office of Child Services.
I guess I would say that's on a case by case basis. You know, obviously, if it's a student who is eminently contemplating self harm, that would go faster track than a student who's just experiencing anxiety, you know, or some, you know, with, you know, anxiety of social, you know, if they're socially not comfortable at school, for example, or they're depressed and not, you know, engaged in their learning or something. And I think, you know, first of all, the clinic, a lot of the services that we provide are often, we do a lot of physicals so that kids can participate in sports. And so that alone is sort of self-selecting of these are higher functioning kids that want to be involved in things in school. Like, we're not necessarily seeing some of these kids that are very depressed and not engaged in their learning. And those are oftentimes kids that aren't even at school as much because it's hard for them to get there. So, sorry, I'm not totally able to answer your question. I think, like, school counselors would have a better handle on that of how quickly they report things to OCS if a parent is not addressing a mental health need for a student. But I would say it's pretty rare for the kids that we see, but it would be a self-harm related issue.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no other questions for Ms. Ireland, thank you for your testimony. Our last testifier today is Bella Gunther Chavez, a student at South Anchorage High School.
Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Great.
Perfect. Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and respected committee members. My name is Bella Gunther Chavez. I'm a senior at South Anchorage High School. Today, I'm calling in to voice student support on House Bill 232 to ensure early intervention and access to essential mental health support services for Alaska's youth. At my high school, we only currently have school counselors whose jobs are to help students with their school schedules. They have very basic training in therapy, yet students come to their counselors seeking help with anxiety, depression, and navigating mental health challenges. Many students show up to their counselor's office in the middle of a mental health crisis. I've literally seen this. I've been waiting outside the door like, oh, I need help in my school schedule, and they're talking someone out of committing suicide. These school counselors help students by referring them to trained mental health professionals to assist students in need. To do this, counselors have to reach out to the parents of students. However, a lot of parents drop the ball on following up or don't want to give consent for students to receive mental health support, even if the students requested it themselves. This may be due to students' problems stemming from their home lives, parents brushing off their children's feelings, or parents not believing in mental health. Last year, I had a friend who seemed perfectly fine. She was socially engaged and involved in school and extracurriculars. However, she was secretly struggling with her mental health and no one knew. Tragically, she attempted to take her life. Thankfully, she is still with us today. Shortly after her attempt, doctors diagnosed her with major depressive disorder, a neurological brain disorder that impacted her mood, changing the status of her mental health. If teens ever notice a change in their mental state, like experiencing feelings of despair or constant sadness, they should share these concerns with their parents, they can be brushed off, and this can lead to deadly consequences. This bill would empower students to advocate for themselves and their health needs, because at the end of the day, only the person struggling knows what they're feeling or experiencing. Teens can be their best advocates if we let them. This legislation would do that if passed, and serve as early intervention, allowing teens to gain access to medical professionals who can assist their needs and equip them with coping skills needed to handle life challenges, especially before things escalate. Throughout my high school journey, I have witnessed the rise of youth mental health needs, and I've lost friends and classmates to suicide. I am heartbroken that these individuals felt like there was no hope. I vow to honor them by finding ways to support mental health initiatives. Reflecting upon my Christian faith, I know that expanding access to mental health services is not just about providing care. It is an essential part of protecting each person's inherent dignity. If passed, House Bill 232 has the ability to save lives and allow teens to seek help in a timely manner, free from judgment. Thank you for your time, and I hope you pass this bill.
Thank you. Representative Gray?
Thank you. Through the chair to Bella, thank you so much for taking the time to provide your testimony today. You did a great job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Bella, for your testimony. Before we close on discussion on House Bill 232, I wanted to see if Ms. Brown, if you wanted to come up and do that sectional that we didn't do earlier.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it would be, just to be clear, we should read the whole sectional. Thank you.
For the record, Paige Brown, staff to Senator Kathy Kiesel. Section 1 amends the examination and treatment of minors statute, and it adds youth who provide documentation demonstrating that they are an unaccompanied homeless minor to the list of minors who can consent to medical treatment. This section would also add behavioral health and mental health to the list of services an unaccompanied minor, a minor living apart from their parents or legal guardian, and a minor who is the parent of a child are able to consent to. Section 2 adds new subsections to the Examination and Treatment of Minors statute relating to documentation required by homeless unaccompanied minors for the purposes of giving consent. It requires that the documentation must state that the minor is 16 years of age or older, does not have a fixed, regular, adequate nighttime residence, and is not in the care and physical custody of a parent or guardian. The document must also be signed by a director or designee of a director of a governmental or nonprofit entity that receives funds to provide assistance to those who are homeless, a local educational agency liaison for homeless youth, a local educational agency foster care point of contact, or a licensed clinical social worker employed by a school in the state, an attorney that represents the minor, or the minor and two adults with actual knowledge of the minor's situation. Section 3 adds a new section to the parent and child statutes that would give a minor age 16 years or older the ability to consent to receive 5 90-minute sessions of outpatient behavioral health or mental health appointments without obtaining the consent of the minor's parent or guardian. A mental health provider may not prescribe medication without consent of the parent or guardian. After the 5th appointment, a provider may continue to provide services to the minor if attempting to get consent from the minor's parent or guardian would be detrimental to the minor's well-being by the behavioral or mental health services are related to allegations of neglect, sexual abuse, or mental or physical abuse by the minor's parent or guardian, or that the provider finds that requiring the consent of the minor's parent or guardian would cause the minor to reject services. Failing to provide services would be detrimental to the minor's well-being. The minor sought services knowingly and willingly, and the minor has the maturity to productively participate in services. as well as the provider determines that contacting the parent or guardian would not be detrimental to the minor's well-being. The provider has informed the minor that parental consent is required to continue services. The provider has made at least two unsuccessful attempts to contact the minor's parent or guardian by email, by mail, email, phone, and the mental health provider has written consent of the minor. If a provider continues treatment due to the belief that obtaining consent from the minor's parent or guardian would be detrimental to the minor's well-being, the mental or behavioral health provider may continue services with documentation of the determination in the patient's clinical record, written consent from the minor, and evaluations every 60 days about if the minor's well-being is continually in question until either the provider discontinues services or the minor turns 18 years of age. If a mental health provider has decided to continue services due to the belief that obtaining the parent or guardian's consent would be detrimental to the minor's well-being, they may not contact the minor's parent or guardian without written consent from the minor. A provider may not disclose the information to the parent or guardian of the minor if the minor chooses to continue services after being informed that they must obtain parental consent after 5 sessions. A provider may deny a minor's parent or guardian access to any part of the minor's clinical record if the provider has compelling reasons to deny the parent or guardian access. A parent or guardian is relieved of any financial obligation to pay for services consented to by this new section. Nothing in this new section can be taken as an excuse to remove liability of the person performing the examination or treatment for failure to meet typical standards of care in the state. Section 4 amends the legal custody, guardianship, and residual parental rights and responsibilities and adds the new section from Section 3 to the list of exceptions of a parent's residual rights and responsibilities. Section 5 amends the same statute with the same information. And then Section 6 is the effective date for January 1st, 2026.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Do we have any further questions or discussions on HOSPO 232 from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Brown, and for Senator Giesel and also Representative Gray for bringing this bill forward and presenting it to the committee. At this time, I'm setting HOSPO 232 aside for a future hearing. Looking forward to next week. There will be no meetings of the standing committee, but I will see you all here for our first finance subcommittee meeting on Tuesday, January 27th. The time is 4:59 p.m., and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.